negotiations continue as the U.S. inches closer to defaulting on its debt.
It will lead to a downgrading of paper of U.S. creditworthiness, and the consequences are just earth-shattering.
Plus, a major Ukrainian nuclear power plant loses its external power supply for the seventh time since the Russian invasion.
The plant's six nuclear reactors are protected by a reinforced shelter able to withstand hits, but a disruption in the electrical supply could disable cooling systems essential for the reactor's safety.
And in Iraq, people are rebuilding their lives and robots are helping. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met Monday at the White House on the impasse over the government's debt ceiling. Washington is seeking to strike a budget compromise to raise the nation's borrowing limit in time to avert a potentially devastating federal default as soon as next week. Briefing reporters as the two met in the Oval Office, President Biden said he was optimistic an agreement could be reached.
We still have some disagreements, but I think we may be able to get where we have to go. We both know we have a significant responsibility.
McCarthy agreed, but pointed to spending cuts as the framework for a deal.
I think we both agree that we need to change the trajectory, that our debt is too large. And I think at the end of the day, we can find common ground, make our economy stronger, take care of this debt, but more importantly, get this government moving again to curb inflation. Make us less dependent upon China.
I spoke with American University professor Thomas Kahn, who served as staff director for the U.S. House Budget Committee for 20 years. So we know negotiations are continuing. It's really getting down to the wire. What happens if the U.S. defaults on its debt?
We've never defaulted before, and I think we all have to pray that this is not the first time. If we do default, it will probably trigger a recession. If we're not in one already, it will result in the loss of several hundred thousand jobs. Interest rates will skyrocket. It will rock the international markets. It will lead to a downgrading of paper of U.S. creditworthiness. And the consequences are earth-shattering. In 2011, we came within 48 hours of default. So we didn't default, but we came within 2 days of it. And our creditworthiness was downgraded for the first time in history. Interest rates shot up, and it ended up costing the taxpayers more than $1 billion.
And what are the global implications?
Well, the global implications are that it would cast a shadow over U.S. debt in the future. Some investors might be less willing to purchase U.S. bonds. Right now, U.S. bonds are the best investment in the world. We are the default currency, the dollar. But, you know, unfortunately, the Chinese are trying very hard to shake the role of the United States as the reserve currency. They are encouraging some other countries, some of the oil-producing countries, for example, and some Latin American countries to use their currency rather than the dollar. They haven't succeeded yet, but if we do default, I think that would certainly be a gift to them.
And how risky is this brinksmanship so close to this deadline? And is it already doing potential damage when it gets this close?
Not yet. The markets have not really reacted because the markets still anticipate that there will be a deal in time. But every day that goes by without a deal makes default more likely and risks a market reaction.
Why do we have a debt ceiling if we are constantly paying for things on credit?
It's an interesting question. The United States is one of only two countries in the world that has a debt ceiling cap, and it's a statutory limit that Congress has imposed on the amount that the government can borrow. It's kind of an odd law because Congress passes bills spending money, and then once we've already spent the money, essentially the president has to go back to Congress to get permission to have spent the money. The time to control the spending is when Congress passes it, not now. It's sort of like having a credit card and charging up the limit, and then once you get the bill from the credit card company, telling them, well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay it because it exceeds my debt cap. It's money we've already spent, we've already passed, already obligated. And I might add, by the way, it's interesting because the debt ceiling was increased three times under President Trump without fanfare. And so this should not be a partisan issue. Look, there is a very legitimate question about the size of U.S. debt and deficits, and it's important that the Congress and the president address it. However, the debt ceiling is not the right vehicle to do so. And playing brinksmanship with the U.S. creditworthiness is the worst way to engage in this kind of brinksmanship.
American University Professor Thomas Kahn, the longest-serving staff director for the House Budget Committee. Thank you so much for being with us. Ukrainian officials said Monday that Russian forces used missiles and drones to carry out overnight attacks on the Dnipropetrovsk region, injuring at least 8 people and leaving residential buildings damaged. And Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant switched to emergency diesel generators after losing its external power supply for the 7th time since the Russian invasion. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The head of the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, says in a tweet, "The nuclear safety situation at the plant is extremely vulnerable. We must agree to protect it now. This situation cannot continue." Grossi appeals for the area to be spared from the fighting between Ukrainian and Russian troops. IAEA staff are deployed at the plant, which is occupied by Russian forces. The plant's 6 nuclear reactors are protected by a reinforced shelter able to withstand hits, but a disruption in the electrical supply could disable cooling systems essential for the reactor's safety. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's defense minister says the country's forces are still advancing in the northern and southern flanks of Bakhmut in an effort to encircle the Russian troops who they say captured the city over the weekend. Matthew LaRotonda with Reuters continues our coverage.
Ukrainian forces say that they're continuing to advance on the northern and southern flanks of the city of Bakhmut in an attempt to encircle and trap the Russian troops inside, just days after Moscow claimed to have finally captured it through 8 months of grinding warfare. And the developments are now giving both sides reasons to claim that momentum is in their favor in a landscape Ukraine's President Zelensky has recently compared to the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. This was video released by Russia's Wagner mercenary group over the weekend, claiming to show its forces raising their flags in the rubble. Reuters was able to verify the drone views, but not when it was filmed. Ed Arnold is with the Royal United Services Institute think tank in London.
It looks like Bakhmut is still contested, but ultimately speaking, you need to see the battle in a wider picture that the Russians have pushed everything they had at it since August, and they've only just sort of captured the town. But equally, when you look at the imagery, I mean, there's nothing left of the town. It's a very insignificant point on the broader map. And actually what's really been, it's all been about is to try and fix each fort so that they can't fight in other places within Ukraine. And the issue now is that the Russians will just find themselves in an area that they might not even be able to stay in long term because the infrastructure does not exist. So then the ability to then keep the city in their hands and then continue further west is going to be very, very difficult.
Meanwhile, in another mocking public statement against Russia's regular military establishment, the Wagner Group's head, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has repeated his vow to pull his mercenaries out of the city starting on May 25th, handing over control to government forces. He's accusing the military of abandoning the flanks even as his mercenaries advanced, which the defense ministry denies. The coming weeks will show just how much the massive losses of life in Bakhmut have impacted the wider war.
Matthew LaRotonda reporting for Reuters. The United States and Papua New Guinea signed a pair of security deals Monday during a rare visit by the U.S. Secretary of State. The agreements are part of Washington's broader attempt to counter China's influence in the Pacific. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, the region wants more sustained engagement from the United States.
Under the new agreements, U.S. forces can access airfields and ports in Papua New Guinea. The U.S. also pledged tens of millions of dollars to boost security cooperation. The deals will be fully transparent, vowed top U.S. diplomat Anthony Blinken.
We are deeply invested in the Indo-Pacific because our planet's future is being written here. Papua New Guinea is playing a critical role in shaping that future.
Blinken's visit is the latest attempt to show U.S. commitment to a region with growing Chinese influence. But the mood of the visit was dampened. U.S. President Joe Biden and Japan for the G7 summit had planned to make the first ever trip to Papua New Guinea by a sitting U.S. president, as well as a stop in Sydney. Instead, Biden headed home to deal with negotiations over raising the U.S. borrowing limit. A major disappointment, says Australia-based analyst Joe Siracusa.
Look, nobody in the world of diplomacy likes to be overlooked. And the fact that these countries take about 6 months preparation, you know, for a presidential visit, it's a big deal.
Papua New Guinea had declared a public holiday for Biden's visit. Instead, it welcomed several other heads of state Monday. White House official John Kirby told VOA last week Biden's visit to Papua New Guinea may be rescheduled. But for many in the region, the big worry is whether Washington political chaos will hamper sustained U.S. focus on Asia. Many also fear an overly militarized approach to the region, says Siracusa.
Is they want the United States to do something about climate change. They think they're sinking under the water, and many of them are, while the United States doesn't do much about climate change.
But alongside Blinken on Monday, Papua New Guinea officials praised the deal with the United States, saying it would boost the country's national defense during a time of growing global uncertainty. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Sudan's army conducted airstrikes in the capital Khartoum on Monday, seeking to win ground against its paramilitary rivals, hours before a week-long ceasefire aimed at allowing delivery of aid was due to take effect. The army has been targeting rival mobile units that have been operating across residential areas in the capital. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said on Monday that he will not seek to form a coalition government following this weekend's election, paving the way for a second vote in June that he hopes his conservative party will win outright. His stunning win against the leftist Syriza came despite a wiretapping scandal, the COVID pandemic, a cost of living crisis, and a deadly rail crash that enraged the public. And Israel's Defense Ministry Director General said Monday it aims to parlay its technological prowess to become an artificial intelligence superpower and predicted advances in autonomous warfare and streamlined combat decision-making. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. The United Nations Weather Agency reported that the economic damage caused by weather and climate-related disasters is increasing, despite improved early warning systems reducing the human toll. Over the past 50 years, nearly 12,000 extreme weather, climate, and water-related events worldwide have caused the deaths of more than 2 million people and resulted in economic losses of $4.3 trillion. The agency emphasized the need to enhance alert systems for extreme weather events by 2027, as well as increase efforts to mitigate climate-related risks. The agency highlighted the impact of man-made climate change on the frequency and intensity of extreme weather, such as floods, hurricanes, and heat waves. Most of the economic damage occurred in the United States, while the majority of deaths were in developing countries. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Nigerian authorities are warning citizens of intense flooding ahead of this year's rainy season. Typically, Nigeria sees significant rainfall between June and October, and last year the country saw its worst flooding in a decade, which the United Nations says killed more than 600 people and displaced about 1.4 million. The threat of intense rains earlier than expected will be bad for vulnerable communities, especially those who are still suffering from the impact of last year's flooding. Timothy Obiju has this report from Maiduguri.
Temporary sheds in northeastern Nigeria's Gwoza, Borno State. Thousands who fled conflict from their homes find shelter and safety. The camp is among more than 70 supported by the United Nations International Organization for Migration, or IOM. Last year, severe flooding hit the camp and ravaged many shelters, displacing, for a second time, some 10,000 people. Here, IOM is constructing drainage canals in the camp ahead of a rainy season. Prestige Murima is IOM's deputy chief of mission.
In the camps, they already have so little to themselves. And when the rains come in, as we saw last year, they destroyed essentially everything.
Last year's flooding was fueled by unprecedented heavy rainfalls in combination with the release of excess water from Lagdo Dam in northern Cameroon. The National Emergency Management Agency, NEMA, said about 600 people were killed and 3 million were affected across 31 out of Nigeria's 36 states. And now, NEMA is warning of a significant risk of heavy flooding across the country in the coming months. In addition to drainage canals, IOM is also promoting hygiene and awareness campaigns on the risks of disease outbreaks, especially cholera. Flooding last year triggered a deadly cholera outbreak in the area. Borno State is the most impacted by armed conflict in Nigeria. Millions of displaced people are in staggering need of humanitarian assistance, especially food. In another camp near Nigeria's border with Cameroon, residents like Jennifer Agbajida say they're still facing the impact of last year's floods. She says, flood and elephants destroyed our plants, and because of that, some of us go to Cameroon to farm to get some money for food. Some others take big risks to go to the bush to get some firewood to sell. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator Mafia Shimali says climate change is to blame and that authorities must improve spending on infrastructure.
And so, of course, there need to be serious investments into climate change adaptation and mitigation, as, for example, planting mangroves and bamboos along roads and reinforcing river banks.
With more publicity and awareness about extreme weather, authorities hope to reduce the impact of flooding in Nigeria this year. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Maiduguri, Borno State,
After an
Nigeria.
Anonymous TikToker created a song using artificial intelligence that fooled many into thinking it was made by pop stars, experts say the music industry will have to decide how to handle AI music. Deanna Mitchell has the story.
From the lyrics to the beat to the voices, a song posted by anonymous TikToker Ghostwriter977 sounded just like megastar musicians Drake and The Weeknd. Heart on My Sleeve, made with artificial intelligence, impressed fans, but had some in the music industry crying foul. And experts say it's not that hard to do.
You know, once a computer has a sort of understanding of the patterns that underlie voice in general, you don't need necessarily a lot of data from The Weeknd to generate, you know, sounds that sound like him.
Universal Music Group, which represents both artists, released a statement emphasizing the need to protect artists' music. Experts say experiments like this with AI are just the beginning.
The toothpaste is not going back in the tube. We have to learn how to best live with it.
Fiebring says the music industry will have to decide how to fight or use AI.
Do they decide that it's the best way to make money is to start churning out AI songs that don't have much human involvement?
But the musician Grimes launched an AI voice software, allowing others to create music with her voice, as long as they split the royalties 50%. Deanna Mitchell for VOA News.
It's been more than a decade since the end of the Iraq War. Much of the country still bears the scars of the U.S.-led invasion. But Iraqis today are working to clean up their country, and some have turned to technology for help. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
A massive reconstruction plan is underway in Iraq. In the country's capital, Baghdad, diggers, bulldozers, and other heavy equipment are rebuilding neighborhoods. Infrastructure projects are aimed at repairing sewage and water systems as well as sidewalks and roadways. It's a push by Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani's government to improve basic services in a country pockmarked by years of conflict from invasion as well as internal factions warring for power. A few hours' drive away in Basra is a robot-operated factory producing chemical adhesives and the liquid materials used in construction. The German-made machines operating this facility are fifth generation, meaning they use advanced artificial intelligence and operate without human interaction. The high-tech setting means more output, fewer workers, and less chance for human error throughout the process.
Robots help save a lot of things. For example, time is definitely less with a robot than with manpower, in addition to saving effort. With manpower, we would need at least 100 to 150 workers, while now the factory is operated by only 25 employees, just to supervise, but not to interfere with production or anything else.
Al-Moussaoui added that robotic precision guarantees flawless materials for as many as 3 decades. But with manpower, he says, mistakes are inevitable, and no such guarantees can be made. The Basra factory is near the Iraq-Kuwait border, and Al-Moussaoui says they plan to export their goods to neighboring countries after meeting local demand. Back in Baghdad, the roughly $400 million public works project rolls on, something the city's mayor says was impossible after the national government's collapse and the rise of the Islamic State militant group locally known as Daesh.
Today, thank God, there is security, stability, and an abundance of funds, and a government that wants to provide services to the people of the city. Most protests that happened in the previous period were results of lack of services. And this is what promoted the current government to put on its priorities and in its government program provision of services that suffered from a significant shortage after 2013.
Iraq is an oil-rich country. It collected more than $115 billion from sales in 2022, helping to fund the infrastructure improvements. And these reconstruction projects are just the beginning, as Reuters reports the Tigris River is packed with sewage and trash, both of which remain untreated. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most rapidly evolving challenges to human rights is technology, warned Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a speech to Freedom House. For a time, it seemed that leaps in technology would tilt the balance of power away from human rights abusers in favor of human rights defenders. Yet in many of the same places where human rights defenders are using technology for good, authoritarians and repressive regimes have abused technology to carry out their own transgressions. Our human rights future is going to be shaped in 4 key areas, the first being surveillance technology, explained Secretary Blinken.
Our digital lives make us all vulnerable to new forms of surveillance tech. Journalists, political activists, opposition figures, human rights advocates, others across nearly every continent have been targeted with commercial spyware that's readily available to governments and non-governmental actors alike.
We know unfettered access to the Internet is essential for defending human rights and human freedoms, noted Secretary Blinken. But according to Freedom House, Internet censorship and shutdowns by governments are now at an all-time high.
Ida Gajar's news outlet, Iran Wire, used the Internet to receive critical information from inside Iran to do everything from documenting an accurate death toll from the repression of protests to sharing live footage of the regime's crackdown to gathering and disseminating reporting by its network and citizen journalists.
While we're working to promote access to the Internet for all, we're also working to address online harassment, abuse, disinformation, noted Secretary Blinken. Technology and human rights are converging over artificial intelligence and biotechnologies, including genomics, warned Secretary Blinken.
Advances in biotechnology have enabled genomic surveillance based on a person's DNA, potentially facilitating abuses. And we've seen some of those, for example, committed by the People's Republic of China against Uyghurs and other minorities in Xinjiang. We're also concerned by reports of the spread of mass DNA collection to Tibet as an additional form of control and surveillance over the Tibetan population.
the State Department will continue to ramp up emergency support and legal assistance to those who are out there defending human rights around the world and work with its civil society partners like Freedom House on how to best defend and advance human rights in the face of evolving threats.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.